It's an investigation of moisture interaction with cellulose using solid-state NMR. And I don't know how familiar everybody is with NMR, much less solid-state, but I'm going to try to take you through the experiment as best I can and not lose you too bad. The study is based on a paper that's recently been published online in the Journal of Molecular Structure. The principal author is Robert Taylor, and he's a researcher at the University of California in Los Angeles, where he works in the Department of Chemistry. He was the one responsible for planning and conducting and interpreting most of the data that you'll see. And I'm going to try to present it for him. The rest of the authors you see here, including Al and myself, David Himmelsbach, Bob Stepanovich. I misspelled a couple of them here, but Devin Thibodeau, Phil Wakeman, he's from the National Cotton Council, and Dabowski, what's his first name? Charles Dabowski, I think. He's University of Delaware. So by way of introduction, the moisture content in cotton is an important influence on the fiber properties, primarily due to its enhancement of fiber strength. The mechanism by which moisture imparts this strength is poorly understood, and so a better understanding may lead to improvements in breeding, processing, and yarn quality. The purpose of this study was to investigate the interaction between moisture and cellulose by utilizing solid-state NMR, both proton and carbon-13. It addresses the effect of moisture on proton spin dynamics via a spin diffusion experiments, which are designed primarily to study heterogeneous systems such as the cotton fiber. But what I mean by that is the cotton fiber, it's made up primarily of cellulose, but it also has zones of moisture content as well as pectin, wax, and other things like that. All right, now this is the basic diagram of the solid state experiment that we utilized. And this one's a little more complicated, but I'll try to take you through it. This is solid state cross polarization magic angle spinning experiment, which here is including this proton evolution time, which isn't normally there, which is for a standard carbon-13 experiment. What the standard experiment is you have an initial pulse of the protons, which aligns the proton magnetization perpendicular to a permanent magnetic field. Following that pulse, there's a cross-polarization period where the polarization is transferred from protons to the carbon-13. And the reason this works so well for solids is that carbon-13 is available and it's fairly rare in materials, whereas the protons are very abundant. And so this cross-polarization is a much more effective way of looking at the carbon-13 spectrum as compared to directly trying to directly look at carbon-13. So after this cross-polarization, you can then look at the resonance coming from the carbon-13, whether those protons that were initially cross-polarized, if they're in fairly direct contact with the carbon-13, you'll see the resonance. Now, this is an example of a carbon-13 spectrum that you get by utilizing that pulse sequence. This is the CP mass spectrum of a Pima cotton that we looked at in this study. And you'll see from the figure here that you see all of the primary resonances from the cellulose, the C1 through C6 carbons. And something of note here is that you see the C4 and the C6 carbons, which are split into two different components. And these two different components are sort of indicative of ordered versus less ordered regions, or in other words, crystalline versus amorphous cellulose. And up above, you'll see it's an expansion of the spectrum. You can also see a bit of a resonance arising from the aliphatic groups on the wax and some carbonyl groups, which may be from residual pectins or the wax itself as well. Now, when we go back to this diagram, it's a little more complicated than the previous one, but I want to try to explain this is sort of the heart of what this experiment is. It has to do with spin diffusion. These protons are excited, and then they're going to diffuse through space and time, and we're going to try to utilize that in order to get some information about dimensions of these different structures. So this initial sequence of proton pulses is called the Goldman-Shin sequence, after the originators of it. So what happens is you have the initial pulse, which again, it transfers the proton magnetization to a position perpendicular to the main magnetic field. And then then you have this evolution time that we label T1. During this time, if nothing else is going on, you can get a distinction between protons in rigid environments versus protons in more mobile environments. So if this evolution period is long enough, you'll get a total decay of the rigid proton component, and all you'll be left with is the mobile signal. So after this evolution time, there's a secondary pulse applied, and that brings the magnetization back to the z-axis. And what happens after this point is then we have a mixing period. And bringing it back to the z-axis allows those protons in the mobile component to re-cross-polarize with the protons in the rigid domain. So, and you can kind of see here what happens. Those protons in the rigid domain had decayed to zero, but now they mix with the remaining polarization of the mobile protons, and the magnetization builds back up. So after this mixing period, you have that same pulse again and a cross-polarization, and then it allows you to look at the carbon-13 spectrum. And depending on this mixing time, you may see the carbon-13 spectrum of just the rigid domain or carbon-13 of the mobile domain if it exists. In this case, it's going to turn out that the mobile domain consists primarily of just water, it looks like. There's no mobile carbon components. Okay, so taking that initial pulse sequence, I'm going to try to break it down a little bit. This first trace, A, is just a static proton spectrum without any kind of spinning or anything like that. And so you make the 90-degree pulse, and you immediately gather the data, and what you see is this broad component underneath, which is indicative of the protons in a rigid domain. They decay much faster, and after a Fourier transformation, you wind up with a very broad peak. This sharp narrow peak on top of it is due to the proton signal arising from that mobile domain, which is, again, it's primarily water. So you remember, if we put that decay phase in there, or that evolution phase, assuming it's long enough, you can get rid of that broad component, and all you'll have left is the mobile component. Okay. So how do we use that to our advantage? That comes in the next step with that mixing phase then. And this is kind of hard to see, and I apologize for this, but I'll try to. This is similar to the previous slide, but now we have the same evolution phase where that rigid component is disappearing, and then we put in that mixing phase where we transfer the polarization from the mobile component to the rigid component again at different mixing times. And that's what all these little figures indicate, is the different mixing times. The one on the bottom here is the one with the shortest mixing time. So the mobile component has transferred some polarization, but not a lot. But as you go up in mixing time up to 100 milliseconds, you can see that broad component builds in fairly strongly again. Okay. And this is a more graphical representation of what's going on with the last figure. The fractional recovery of that rigid phase proton spectrum as a function of that mixing time. In this case, it's the square root of the mixing time. You can see that we get recovery at least up to 100 milliseconds, and it's fairly linear correlation. Now, I need to point out that after 100 milliseconds, this line would not keep going up. It actually plateaus, and you get no more no more mixing. And that's going to be important for how we're going to determine these phase domains sizes. Okay, this is kind of complicated, so I'll try to be as easy as I can here.
As if everything else hasn't been.
Yeah. These are two-dimensional correlation plots. On this axis, you see that it's the carbon signal, and it can be correlated with the proton that it was cross-polarized with. So essentially, the carbon signal, it depends on what that initial proton was, okay? In this case, this figure A, we have this cross-polarization. It's called wide line separation spectrum for this two-dimensional aspect. There's no Goldman-Shin evolution period or mixing time. So the only cross-polarization we're getting from the protons to the carbons are in the rigid domain, so because you see none of those sharp peaks. So this indicates that only the broad proton component is cross-polarizing with the cellulose. In the next case, we have the same sort of spectrum, except in this case, we've included mixing time, okay? And that's, there was an evolution time. I'm not sure what it was in this case, but after that evolution, there's the half millisecond mixing time. And in this case, remember, when we get through the mixing time, we're repolarizing that the broad component of the proton spectrum by utilizing the polarization from the mobile component. So if we have this mixing time, then the correlation of the proton with the carbon 13 indicates that the carbon 13 has been getting some of its polarization, at least indirectly, through that mobile proton component, which is, again, it appears to be the water phase because there's really no other mobile component there other than possibly wax, but we ruled that out by looking at a sample that we stripped all the wax off. Now, in the case, I don't have a figure for this, but down at the bottom here, you see in the case of if we have a Goldman-Shin sequence that has an evolution period where that rigid domain proton disappears and then have no mixing time, we'll get no cross-polarization at all. That is, you get no carbon 13 spectrum. And that's indicating that the narrow proton component is not in direct contact with the cellulose. Okay. Now, using all this information, we're going to try to come up with what this means as far as how large some of these domains are within the cotton fiber. That is, okay, there's moisture in the fiber, and you can transfer polarization via a spin diffusion process back into the rigid structure if you set up your pulse sequences right. So this distance here is if we use a standard sort of diffusion law, and we assume that it's a lamellar type structure, that is just different layers, you can almost consider them infinite. The diffusion law in this case would be the distance traveled by those spins during the mixing time is equal to all this, where the x is the average distance traveled, d is the diffusion coefficient, and t sub n is the mixing time that was used. And in the present case, you remember from a couple of slides ago, I had told you that after 100 milliseconds, the diffusion seems to have ended. So 100 milliseconds seems to be the maximum amount of time that the spin diffusion is occurring. So if we use that number for T sub m, and we use a reported spin diffusion coefficient of for mobile water of 0.15 square nanometers per millisecond, we come up with this average distance traveled of 4.4 nanometers. Okay. So what does that mean? A single monolayer of unbound water has a reported thickness of 0.31 nanometers, and I've referenced you on that. I'm not sure where that comes from, actually. But
density of water.
Yeah, okay. So assuming this to be pretty close to the case, then we have a 4.4 nanometer total thickness of this water layer times number of monolayers times the thickness of that monolayer, and we can determine that there are 14 monolayers of water within that domain of free moisture. Now, a typical Pima cotton cell wall thickness might be 2.5 microns or 2,500 nanometers. At a 5% moisture content, which was about the case in this study, and we assume equal densities of cellulose and water, then the total thickness of the combined water layers is 125 nanometers. So this translates to 28 separate layers, each of 4.4 nanometer thickness. And this is significant in that it kind of verifies or at least corroborates some theories presented by Rollins and Hagler that water is present in these growth cotton grows in sort of diurnal layers, and they sort of established by photomicrographs of swollen cotton fiber that you have these different layers. Now this is a cotton fiber cross section that's been swollen, probably in sodium hydroxide or something. I'm not sure about that, but you can see from this that the that these intercellulose layers they seem fairly concentric, although they're not perfect rings or that go around. But at any rate, there are definitely domains where the water is and from there they actually counted these things by microscopy and determined that there were anyway from like 27 to 34. Of these rings present. So if I go back, the calculations we've done, it indicates 28 separate layers of this moisture. So it's a pretty good verification of that theory, I think. And that's all I've got.
Another really good evidence for this layer structure was some work that Larry Yatsu did with green cotton, and you could see they were very, they used never dried cotton that had been fixed, mm-hmm. So you could see that right. Very concentric, oh, yeah. Beautiful concentric mm-hmm. rings, and Hagler's image was also of the concentric rings.
Right. So, that was an immature cotton too,
very cold nights in West
okay.
Texas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Somehow that led to the visibility of these diurnal rings that aren't usually visible.
Yeah.
And this was embedded in methacrylate and I've forgotten just how that lattice expansion happened, but the methacrylate embedded may have had mm-hmm. something to do with prying those layers apart.
Right. So. Yes.
Let's say you put cotton in the vacuum desiccator,
right.
P205 pumped down for a week.
Uh-huh.
You think you'd still see these monolayers?
You would not. If you do that, that kind of we describe that. That would be sort of the case. It would be similar to this case here, where there's. You would essentially have no mobile water there. So when you try when you try to use these mixing times, there would be no mobile component present to transfer polarization. So by that time, the protons in the rigid component have decayed to zero, and you'd get no cross polarization at all in that case, right, by using this. So that's.
But do you think that would be the case? Do you think it's possible with the water?
Some bound water, and that's sort of touched on in the full manuscript, and that's sort of beyond my capability of talking. There is a range of different mobilities in water. The bulk of it appears to behave as mobile, but as you get closer to that cellulose surface, they get more and more bound. And their behavior does change, yeah. So I don't know if you're asking if you could still see that water or not. And I'm not sure about that. Did you get any?
There's Yeah, there's a paper in Cellulose within the last year, I think, that suggested that any water less than about 40% water, I think it was, 38%, was bound water.
Right.
You really had to have a lot to have a unbound water. But what we're seeing here is that the water that's bound is a mobile phase, because we're talking 5% water.
Right.
Sorts of levels. I mean, that's just a figure that we picked out of the air for just equilibrated in the Los Angeles. Well, they were down to 9% or something this fall.
You kind of changed from one experiment to another, but I think in this case it was around 5% because you sealed the tube and everything. So,
how does it vary after bleached, processed, scoured?
I would assume it would behave somewhat like this. Like, we did verify some of this we did remove the wax from it using ethanol. We didn't go through the entire scouring process, but the primary component that you see in that carbon 13 spectrum is due to the cellulose. There's very little, there's very small signals for wax and proteins and things like that, but by stripping the wax off, we were able to show that this polarization transfer wasn't due to that wax layer. It was due to some other mobile component, which I guess we've assumed is water, just due to how much there is there.
So we assume this might be a good model for textile fibers as well as.
Yes, I would think so, unless they've been mercerized or something like that. In that case, I'm not sure how that would affect this sort of structure, which might be an interesting thing to look at. But I think part of the thought here is that since, you know, the moisture plays such a strong role in fiber strength, that if we can get some indication of how thick these layers are, we can compare different cottons of different strengths, possibly, or even upland with Pima. There's a lot of other things going on with crystalline structures and things like that too, but if you just looked at the upland cotton and compared raw fiber with mercerized and processed otherwise, there might be some interesting things.
Gary, isn't he continuing some of this work, and so he's going to be looking at this further?
Yeah, we've talked about
that. What's the next phase that he's going to be doing?
Well, I think we talked about comparing it with upland, setting up similar experiments to compare upland cotton with Pima cotton. Now, there's a lot of things we're going to have to control as far as the maturity and measuring the fiber cross-section, just to know how thick this cell wall actually is and things like that. But,
yeah, it is very interesting to be also on polarization matching the spectrum you mentioned. Can you make maybe XY is a carbon 13 and the other one is 915?
I'm not sure. Well, in the case of cotton, I'm not sure you'd get very much. There's not much nitrogen there to begin with. But if you had some materials that were, say, a lateral material that contained a lot of nitrogen in one of the layers, I think this might be possible.
Possibly you can make exit is just carbon 13 and Y.
Right. I'm not sure how good the sensitivity would be. I think protons are pretty robust as far as their intensity goes. Now, I'm not sure about the abundance of nitrogen 15 in any kind of natural product. It may be pretty weak, but it might be doable. I'm not sure though.
Well, thank you very much,
Gary. Thank you.
That's great.